Welcome to the Farmhouse Podcast, where we talk shop with top minds in the world of innovation and design. I'm Paul Earle, Executive Director. Today, September 23rd, is the grand opening of the highly acclaimed David Bowie Is exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. We were fortunate to have been invited in for an advance look, and I gotta tell you, it is sensational. You have to go. It's an amazing experience. Given the show's study of the intersection between music, design, and pop culture, we figured who better to host this month's interview than my friend and colleague, Elisa Wolfson. Elisa is a resident design guru at Leo Burnett and head of Burnett's Department of Design. On the floor of the exhibit, with music and other effects ever present in the background, Elisa sat down with MCA Chief Curator Michael Darling. Enjoy.
I'm here with Michael Darling, the James W. Alsdorf Chief Curator at the MCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to us about David Bowie Is. I'm Elisa Wolfson. I'm the head of design at Leo Burnett Chicago, and I work closely with Farmhouse, an innovation arm of Leo Burnett, and we're here to talk to Michael about innovation and the arts.
Great.
So, great topic. We're talking about David Bowie. I'd like to talk a little bit of, just to set up for our listeners, how the MCA got involved in the Bowie show. You have a little bit of conversation about that.
Yeah. We have a long history at the MCA of doing performance programming. We have a 300-seat theater. We're constantly presenting dance, music, theater. Our exhibitions have for a long time been, you know, mixed very kind of promiscuously, kind of art and fine art, visual art, and performance type arts. So that was already kind of part of our DNA, I think, from the beginning. And also for many, many years, we've often kind of gone outside of the visual arts for exhibitions, done exhibitions about architecture, about furniture design, about fashion design. So we're constantly on the lookout for a show like this that sort of takes us out of our comfort zone and push, and also gives us the opportunity to maybe bring in a different type of visitor to the museum that might discover us for the first time. So we recognized in this Bowie show that opportunity to grab a new audience, invite them in this case, under the auspices of a rock star. But once I started to really look carefully at the exhibition, I realized how natural of a fit this was, considering the kind of collaborators that Bowie had over the course of his career, and also how consistently from the beginning to the end he was cultivating his image, cultivating the look of the concerts, the look of the music videos, the look of his costumes. And so it's really, you know, to use this art history term, this like Gesamtkunstwerk, this total artwork in a way that he's created. I'd say it's not just it's like the whole career has been a series of chapters that he's carefully art directed all the way through. And so it just felt like that was the kind of show that would make so much sense here at the MCA.
And when you first found out about the show, because it was at the Victoria and Albert Museum, that's mostly known for art and design in London, what was your feeling when you first found out about it, and how did you know immediately that it should come to Chicago? And then what was your experience in getting to be the only U.S. venue for the show here?
Yeah, I think I'd read a little early piece about it in the New York Times, maybe, and this was before it even opened in London, and kind of got a sense of that. That's when my ears sort of perked up when I heard about it. So I contacted the folks at the V&A and asked them if this show was available to tour. And believe it or not, at that time, they only had one venue committed, and that was in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And so I immediately said, well, we're interested. We'd like to come out and see the show. We have these dates in mind, September 2014, and started, you know, really considering it seriously then. And very soon thereafter, too, you know, once we recognized that there was a good chance of us bringing it here, we also said, you know, we really also want to make sure we're the first American venue for this, because we really thought that being first would help to galvanize the interest around the show, the media interest around the show. And so that was always a negotiating point from the very beginning, once we really started talking seriously about it.
I mean, how often does that happen, where all the stars align and you make the call, or you read the article and you make the call and you get a great collaborator overseas and they, you know, are having a great experience working on the show, and then all of a sudden now you're the only U.S. venue? Does that happen? Can you think of a time where
that's happened before? No, but I think it sort of just feels more like the way we operate at the MCA anyway. We don't kind of sit around dithering whether or not this is going to be popular or not. We just really trust our instincts, and we know that we're in a position to take risks here. That's what contemporary mm-hmm. art's about. That's what the MCA was founded on. So I feel incredibly empowered here to just sort of like go out and do something like this and not, you know, worry what people are going to think, and just know that it's going to fit in with our mission and with the image that we want to put forward in the world.
You know, talking about image, you know, as far as pop culture programming and getting an audience, you know, more interested in coming into the MCA, especially, you know, folks in Chicago, or I think I read that like Chicago is like one of the like number one tourist destinations in the United States for people coming into the United States. It's a really accessible city. And I think it was voted like number one on TripAdvisor or something like that, which I think is really interesting. I mean, can you talk about like the pop nature of the show? Because I mean, of course, I was thinking about this, and I think everybody is. And when I was coming into the preview of the show, there were even two women standing outside talking about the motorcycle show at the Guggenheim Museum a couple or 5 years ago or whatever. And I feel like there's sort of like these blockbuster, more pop culture exhibits that are popping up all over. And I feel like, you know, you mentioned that it's part of your, you know, mission to bring different kinds of culture and experiences to people in Chicago and people in the world. How has that felt, and how has that felt? This is definitely, the show has a different tone than maybe a typical or traditional arts-based show.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always attracted to projects that have multiple points of entry. And oftentimes, I think even the title of an exhibition, even if it's a, you know, hardcore visual art, contemporary art kind of show, a good, snappy, concise, poppy kind of title mm-hmm. can help break the ice for people to get them in the door, give them something to hang on to, and then they're able to start to kind of explore the material that's in the show. I think this is kind of like that too, because David Bowie is the bridge here. Mm-hmm. People think they know who David Bowie is. There's an easy entry point, but once you get into the show and you start to really dig into it, you start to realize just how complex the show is, how many layers it's got. It's not at all superficial. It deals with incredibly potent societal issues like gender identity and things like that, that he was a pioneer with, ideas about reinvention and image cultivation. And so it's an incredibly deep exhibition, I think. But again, you don't need to know that or expect right. that going in, but the Bowie name itself will hopefully bring people in. And I think now that the show is just starting and it's just previewing, we've had some of those art folks in that might be somewhat skeptical that mm-hmm. are recognizing the connections to contemporary art as well. So we're getting, you know, fans and visitors that coming at it from all sorts of different angles, whether it's fashion, it's music, it's poetry, it's stagecraft, it's identity politics, and all of those different areas.
Because, I mean, if you look at everything, and I'm going to read my notes here so I don't miss anything, but, I mean, there's so much stuff around David Bowie is. There's the Changes series of concerts. There's where local musicians will perform the Bowie album. There's the Bowie-influenced food in the restaurant. There's the Bowie shop called the Satellite Store. There's a gala. There's a Bowie ball. There's a Tumblr page. There's a Bowie hotline. And then I, of course, know that tomorrow is actually officially named David Bowie Day by Mayor Rahm Emanuel. I mean, talk about a blockbuster hitting Chicago. Have you ever experienced this type of, you know, descendants of pop culture in a city when it comes to a show or an exhibit at a contemporary art museum?
Yeah,
it's pretty epic.
Yeah, it is. And,
it's amazing.
And even the press preview that you attended, you know, we had 500 people there. I've never been at a museum that has
there were cookies with, you know, yeah. the lightning bolt on yeah. it.
So the press interest and the popular interest has been way beyond anything that I've ever seen in any of the museums I've worked at. But the show is also so ripe for cross programming too. Mm-hmm. I mean, at first we thought, okay, we're going to just plunk down this show, and it's going to be enough for our audience. But then we started thinking about all these amazing local bands that are interested in David Bowie, and so we wanted to bring in them in. And then we were realizing there's amazing filmmakers like Todd Haynes that are mm-hmm. influenced by Bowie. So let's bring him in to talk about this. And so this programming outside of the show started to really grow, and we just couldn't help ourselves. It was just too good to pass up. And then, you know, it's been fun for our cafe to play with this and come up with Bowie-themed food items, which are generating their own articles. And
it's really cool.
You know, we thought it was just sort of a nice kind of marketing ploy to talk to the mayor and see if he would declare this David Bowie Day, you know, kind of the keys to the city kind of idea. And luckily they went along with it because they recognized the kind of tourist draw that this is. But then in turn, Rahm Emanuel is now being called the coolest mayor in
right.
America for doing this. So it's just interesting how it's kind of gone viral in that way and is creating all of these mutually beneficial partnerships and synergies across all these different platforms.
And when you were thinking about, you know, putting the programming together and like getting all of the organizational structure of the exhibit together, and I want you to talk about a little bit about how you organize the show that's different from the show in London. Mm-hmm. But did you also think about ticketing? And, you know, you have a kind of a very, it's not a complicated, but it's a very deep ticketing process that's like no other that I've ever seen from the Contemporary Art Museum. And I'm wondering, you know, how that is helping you organize the show in a different way.
Yeah. Well, we have never in our history sold advance tickets for any of our exhibitions. We've never done timed tickets before, which you often find at mm-hmm. big blockbuster shows. We thought that was necessary with this exhibition because we didn't want visitors to show up and have a bad experience if we're overrun by people. So we wanted to help pace the flow of visitors through the exhibition. So that actually forced the museum to kind of grow up in a way mm-hmm. and adopt some new ticketing systems and policies which affected our website, which then in turn have affected how we kind of gather information mm-hmm. On our visitors, how we communicate with them. So it's been an amazing tool that we probably needed to do at some point, but the David Bowie show sort of forced us to do that. And then, you know, there's also been, it's also made the whole museum kind of pay attention to the way that people interact with the building, arrive at the building, go through the building, how they flow through the exhibition. And so there's a whole kind of customer service angle to it that, again, we've had to really look inward at ourselves across all sorts of departments and make sure that we're going to be giving these hopefully thousands and thousands of visitors the best glimpse of the MCA when they come here, because especially we're guessing that a lot of them this will be their first time.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think you sort of alluded to this, do you think that that'll impact future decisions on how you program different shows, and do you think that this like blockbuster show will lend you the opportunity both in like your back end resources and also like maybe being a little bit more of, you know, risk takers to bring in different types of programming?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the aspects that we think is going to be really useful is because over half of the ticket sales so far have been online. So once we establish that connection with people online, we can do an Amazon-like, mm-hmm. you know, if you like David Bowie, you mm-hmm. might also want to know that we have Michael Clark Company mm-hmm. coming in doing a dance performance. And we also have The Disappears, a local Chicago band, playing one of the Bowie albums. So it's one of those things where we can communicate with our audience in a much more transparent and straightforward way, I think, too, to let them know about other things going on at the museum and connect the dots. And likewise, now that we've got this online ticketing system, people that are buying performance, you know, for instance, tickets might also want to make sure that they know that they could get their David Bowie ticket at the same time. So I think it'll end up being better from a customer service standpoint on our audience, and allow us to serve them better.
So backing up a little bit, just more about you. Earlier in your career in Seattle, you organized a show at the Seattle Museum of Art that you entitled Kurt, and it was all about Kurt Cobain and his life, and it was, you know, unfortunately after he had already passed. How is this show kind of compared, or is it different working with a living artist? And, mm-hmm. you know, I know that you organized the show more chronologically, which is different than what happened in London. Mm-hmm. You know, is there anything that you've kind of learned from your past experience to help, you know, bring this show to life a little bit more?
Yeah, the Kurt exhibition Kurt with a K, of course.
Yes, of course.
We were kind of trying to test out his, with that title, test out his pop cultural name recognition in a way, like, you know, like Elvis or like Madonna or Marilyn, that Kurt kind of, with a K,
right, of course.
You know who we're talking about. But that show, I was really thrilled with that exhibition, and again, it brought people into the museum that otherwise would not have come to the Seattle Art Museum just because it was Kurt Cobain. I met a teenage girl in that show that came with her mom, and she was just a diehard Nirvana fan. She had never, ever been to an art museum before, so that show brought her in the door to see that because of the subject matter. But I think in that exhibition, it was only contemporary artists dealing with and responding to Kurt Cobain. There were no torn flannel shirts. There were no guitar picks. There was none of that stuff
ephemera.
In there. And I did that very specifically because I was worried about the art of the motorcycle kind of effect that this was going to be some. And I hate to use that as an example because I'm actually not a detractor of the Guggenheim's art and the motorcycle art of the motorcycle exhibit. But that kind of exhibit that's maybe highly populist but not very serious or critical. Mm-hmm. So I was leery about that, and I kind of hedged my bets maybe now looking back that I didn't want to include that other more personal ephemera and really wanted it to be only about art. And this show opens that dialogue up. I mean, we're not afraid to show Dave a piece of tissue paper smeared with his lipstick or his cocaine spoon, but mostly because there are all these other things that show a seriousness and a commitment in his career that help balance that out. So you've got those kind of religious relics in the show, but you also have all this other material that shows his creativity and his creative process that I think keeps it in the realm of the serious and not in just a fawning kind of fan based.
Yeah, like super fan. You've collected everything.
Exactly.
I mean, it's obvious that he had a rich archive. How many original pieces were in the archive, if I can remember?
Apparently, 75,000.
Like, that's incredible.
Things that he's collected since the beginning. So it's almost as if he was preparing for this from the beginning of his career. I mean, there are no glaring holes, you know, in this. He's collected this stuff, taken everything seriously, archived it properly, and
it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so now this this exhibit is largely like 400 of those objects that have been curated and organized in such a way that's more easily digestible for us. And since he's a living artist, and I know that the MCA prides itself on a museum that honors the work of contemporary living artists, I found it really cool to learn about his archives and his meticulous control and detail over all facets of his music. He's truly multidisciplinary, and he's literally like crafted and reshaped his persona over the last 40 years. And then it was fascinating to learn that he was not at all involved in selecting any of those 400 pieces from the 75,000 pieces for the original show or for your show, and that he has had no interaction with any of the curators involved in these shows. So I guess the like philosophical question is like, is that the new contemporary artist? Is he a contemporary artist? Should we be like less harsh on the blockbuster status of the show and really look at him more as a living contemporary artist and less of a musician? And where do you really draw the lines?
I mean, to me, it really speaks to his self-confidence in this body of work that he's created. I mean, I could imagine other mature artists from other fields allowing a similar thing to happen, but very rarely a younger artist allowing, you know, the curator to kind of take full control because they're still so unsure about what they've done and they want to try to control the message. I think this is him saying, I know what I've done. I'm very confident about it. I'm going to let you guys come up with the story that you want to tell with these materials. And the thing that's been really smart about it, I think, too, is it's kept the sort of circus out of it. It's it's not about him showing up and sprinkling the fairy dust on there and making everybody go crazy. It's really forced all of us to look at the material itself and imagine the man behind it rather than requiring his presence.
And so he hasn't. To please him,
so
right.
Yeah, he hasn't come to any of the openings. He didn't come to our opening. He's not planning on coming here, as far as we know. So there's a certain kind of objectivity and a neutrality to all this that I think has really benefited the exhibition. I think it's allowed people to take it seriously and not think that it's a flashy media circus or some kind of narcissistic exercise on his part.
And since he's a living artist and hopefully still producing work, did you look at the show differently? Because, I mean, is it done? Is this just one part of a show that might go someplace else and might have additional parts to it? Can
well,
it grow?
I think it could conceivably grow. I think that notion that you're describing is embedded in the title itself. It's mm-hmm. very emphatically
right.
in the presence. David Bowie is not David Bowie was. And it's open-ended. David Bowie is this. David Bowie is that. And so it's tries to suggest that this is a constant process of reinvention and representation. All of the labels are in the present tense too, which is a little mm-hmm. jarring at first. But mm-hmm. then you realize this kind of theme that's in the exhibition. I think we all really resisted using the word retrospective because that has a certain kind of finality or closure mm-hmm. to it. Also, I've been trying to use the word survey a little bit more personally. So I think, and you know, even the most recent album is called The Next Day. I mean, there's this constant sense of looking forward in his work. Even if he come, maybe, you know, we'll bring Major Tom back into a song or something later on after, you know, from In Ashes to Ashes, for instance, after Space Oddity, it's always with a new spin and kind of to push it forward in a different way. And maybe Major Tom, you know, is looking back critically on what had come in the past or something. So there's not a self-satisfied wallowing in the past in any of his career, any aspect of his career, which I think is pretty amazing.
So when you think, I mean, he's a very futuristic, looking forward artist. I mean, I guess I could parallel a contemporary art museum to be very similar, very nimble, kind of looking towards the next, not the next big thing, but, you know, always looking to see if you can kind of get in the pulse or the zeitgeist of what people are talking about. You know, or earlier in your career or tenure, you said that you were going to come here and do, I think you said, a philosophical gut rehab of the MCA, whose ultimate goal is clarity, which I loved, because when I first found out that you were coming here and I thought, gosh, you know, I want a contemporary art museum that stands for something. I'm a lifelong Chicagoan, and I just wanted to, like, have the institution be very nimble and very kind of future-focused and kind of embrace new change, but have, like, a vision going forward. Mm-hmm. Is this clarity? Is this like part of a plan to go forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I really did say that, it sounds okay.
okay.
To me, truthfully, one of the things that was most attractive about this David Bowie show to me is how it addresses this idea of fluid ideas about gender uh-huh. identity in particular, and how that seems like such an important issue in our culture right now. If you think about the attention that the Orange is the New Black kind of
right.
show is getting, or I mean, one very crucial point for me was the Middlesex book by Jeffrey Eugenides. And I mean, I was just hearing a great interview with a filmmaker on the radio yesterday about the show that has Jeffrey Tambor in it as a transgendered person. And so it seems to me that's such an important issue in our culture, and how these ideas about gender roles are just absolutely loosening up. And you see David Bowie doing this 40 years ago, mm-hmm. starting that conversation. And I think that this show helps to put that conversation mm-hmm. into a historical context and has the MCA be a lightning rod for some of those discussions. And we're going to kind of pick up on that theme even further in an exhibition we're doing here later in the fall called Body Doubles, mm-hmm. that also looks at these sort of shifting sands of identity in contemporary art. That there's nowhere in the texts around that show that it mentions David Bowie, but it's in the same building at the same time and has mm-hmm. people like Wu Sang, who's a transgendered artist in the show, and Lorna Simpson playing roles that are both masculine and feminine and old and young in a brand new video that we're acquiring. And Cindy Sherman is in the show, so we're trying to show how the ideas that are percolating in Bowie's work are absolutely essential to the central dialogues of contemporary art these days too.
And then a show like this, David Bowie Is, would hope to bring in some, you know, financial success to the museum. Will that help fuel those types of more critical curatorial shows that dip more into either your permanent collection or different, maybe more emerging artists that are coming out? And will this maybe help fuel like that kind of thinking? Did you guys think about that at all?
No, I don't think so. I think for us, you know, we need to have a certain financial success for this show just to pay for the expenses of this show.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's an expensive show. It wasn't expensive to borrow this show from the Victoria and Albert. The participation fee was not at all out of line with other big exhibitions, but the mounting of it here, mm-hmm. the physical costs we had to go through to put this on, the technology behind it, it's very expensive and elaborate. So there's a lot of investment in the show for us on the front end that led us to create a special ticket price and to really kind of think seriously about getting people through the door. But I think for us, if we break even, that would be
ideal. Success.
And luckily, our museum has got a very good financial standpoint right now. So those more experimental programs are not in danger. I think the thing that we're excited about also is just the audience that we can bring in and introduce mm-hmm. them to the MCA. So it's not about making money. It's about building audience, I mm-hmm. think, more than anything.
So you touched on this a little bit about mounting the show, but there's also an enormous audio component in the show, of course, David Bowie being, you know, primarily known for music. And then can you talk about how Sennheiser, is that how it's pronounced? Mm-hmm. Sennheiser technology makes the experience, like, kind of takes it to a whole new level. I got the privilege of coming through here a couple days early, so I'll be able to come a couple extra days when, you know, we come through as a family. And the audio component of it is so unbelievably sophisticated and cool for a museum. Did that factor into the cost, or did you have to, like, make some compromises because of that, or yeah. how did they play a role?
Well, luckily, Sennheiser is a package deal. They came with the exhibition, and all the expertise that their engineers mm-hmm. brought to the show came with the exhibition. We didn't have to pay anything extra to bring them here. And like you said, it's a crucial aspect of the show. You know, this is a rock star, of course, that we're talking about. So his songs and his music needed to be part of the story. But oftentimes in museum situations, if you have a sound in a room here, it's going to bleed into the next room, or it's going to bounce off of the walls and go in all these unpredictable places. So they really needed a way to control the sound for each visitor, but also to make it sound as good as possible. So mm-hmm. having each person have their own headphones allows you to control that audio experience as much as possible. And the way they've designed it is that we all, of course, go through exhibitions at a different pace, so each person will trigger the soundtrack as they move through the show. So you might go through it in 90 mm-hmm. minutes, and your husband or partner might go through it in 3 hours, and there's no difference. You know, you can stay and watch every single video from start to finish, and the other person can sort of skim over it. So it's very intuitive. You don't have to push any buttons as you're going through. It registers your location in the exhibition, and you're having your own personal experience with the show that's not dictated by some forced march or any kind of timing. So. And that's quite new. There's very few museums that have ever done that before. And I think this technology that Sennheiser has developed for the exhibition will have lots more applications, you know, going forward.
Do you think we'll see another music-based exhibit based on your experience with audio?
And your new
knowledge of sound design?
I think this definitely kind of opens our eyes to new ways of doing that. We mm-hmm. have lots of audio in our exhibitions already, and we, like, as you can probably tell by my comments, like, struggle a lot with how to kind of keep it where you want it to be and how make it sound as good as you want it to sound. And I think this headphone technology really makes that so much easier. So I would not be at all surprised if we get our friends from Sennheiser back here at the museum for another project in the future. And it doesn't have to be about a rock star. I mean, so many artists these days are using video, and it's such a constant of our diet that we have needs for this on a constant basis, actually.
Looking around, I mean, we're actually in one of the exhibit halls right now, and, you know, if you're listening to this, you might be hearing, you know, things in the background as we're talking, and there's literally things like being projected as we're talking, and, you know, in different rooms, there's some sound components, you might be hearing things. Have you had any, you know, corners that you like to go to, or, you know, have been more of a magnet to you, and every time you walk up to it, you just can't pull yourself away? For instance, I'm looking across the room, and, you know, I just can't help but, like, continue to look at that one vignette. Has there been something that has surprised you and kind of pulled you in over and over?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I was looking forward to the most is this last big room of the exhibition, which we kind of call the concert moment. And it's three gigantic walls that wrap around you that have video projections on all three of those walls. And in some of two of the walls, there are costumes embedded behind the screens that video is being projected on. Sometimes you can see into those boxes and you see costumes that Bowie wore in the period. And it's probably about 20 to 30 minutes, the whole cycle, but there's so many amazing moments in that, and I kind of can't get enough of that section. There's one part in particular where he's on the Diamond Dogs tour, and he's in Los Angeles in 1973, I think it is, and just amazing footage of him kind of cruising down Sunset Boulevard, you know, in the back of a cab, and he looks very bedraggled and kind of, you know, coked out, probably. And incredibly vulnerable, basically, is what the thing that I love about that footage. And then you see him performing, and you really are transported, you know, to that time period. And you can see how these costumes are being enacted in live in concert. And so there's some of that material I just kind of can't get enough on. And I think you're at moments in there, you're as close as you can be to a rock concert and still be inside a museum in there because of the visual energy, the sound in there, and I'm really proud of that room and how it comes across.
Was there a room like that in the original show?
Yeah,
that was
absolutely
replicated? I mean, because that, I was blown away when I walked into that room. I thought, oh, this is cool. I'm going to see a projected concert. And then things started moving around me. And then I saw some of the stills kind of projected and, you know, overlapping each other. And then, you know, the walls lit up and I could see the costumery behind the walls. And it became like this dimensional box where so many different things happen. And that's actually where I, you know, kind of planted myself and got really swept up in the moment. And, you know, all of these things that I, you know, when you walk through these other galleries, they seem more tactical and more, you know, like factual. And then, you know, that room just has so much humanity and life to it.
Yeah.
I personally would like to spend, you know, 4 more hours in there.
Yeah.
And I can imagine where if you were organizing the show, that would be a super treat to get to see over and over again.
Yeah, every time that Sweet Thing song came on,
and
I would run from the other room to, like, just sort of soak it in a little bit more. But you coming from, you know, an advertising background, there, that is such an incredibly sophisticated video montage that
it
they
really
created
is.
For that room. But then, like you said, there's also synchronized theatrical lights in there, and the sound component is all of that is absolutely tailor-made to our venue and our space. Our space is, in that room is very horizontal, whereas some of the other venues, especially in London, was much more of a very vertical kind of box. So they had to completely redesign the sound and the video components for that bit. So even if somebody saw and loved that in London, they would get a totally different experience here in Chicago of that room.
And thinking about that, you know, there's so many different people that come through here. You know, we talked about, like, getting the average museum goer versus maybe a more sophisticated person who knows Bowie's career to somebody like me who's in the creative field who maybe has a different sensitivity towards design and music. How do you program something like that? Do you think about how sophisticated it has to be for, you know, a certain audience, and then think about, like, if, you know, other audiences will find it intriguing? And how do you kind of bring, you know, that curatorial innovation into the space and also be able to talk to your average guest?
Well, we spend a lot of time internally thinking about interpretation, and especially what the wall texts say at this museum. We're absolutely committed to them providing as much important and necessary information as possible and delivering that text in as clear of a way as possible so that the most sophisticated visitor can read those texts and get the information that they want and not feel like they're being talked down to. But the most, you know, uninitiated visitor can come through, read them clearly too without being, you know, tripped up by big words and jargon and complicated sentences, and also get the information that they need to kind of make the leap to start understanding what's going on there. And so some of that includes, you know, just being generous with giving birth dates of the people we're talking about in the text, not assuming that you know who Kandinsky is, mm-hmm. or whatever, giving their nationalities too, so that you again can place them in space as well as in time. And so trying to just give those little bits of context, and I think our education staff has really coached our curatorial team to think that way and to not take things for granted, to give people just some of this basic information that again allows for a certain leveling of the audience in a way. So I think that's something that we get great comments on from people is our commitment to our wall texts. And this is a show where you can't have addition. There's no docent tours or anything like that because it's so individual as you walk through. So we really spent a lot of time on those texts, sort of, and we added a lot of things to these texts that didn't exist in London too, because we felt that American audiences mm-hmm. needed more context than the British audience did, especially in terms of Bowie's origins and the places that and people that he was experiencing on his way up the ladder.
So, less about the exhibit and more about your feelings about the exhibit. Has your mood or has your, you know, personal favorite Bowie period changed since you have learned? You probably know more about him than the average person does, well beyond. You know, were you, you know, an Aladdin sane guy and now, you know, you have a completely new like for a David Bowie period?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I was probably really weaned on 80s era Bowie and, you know, kind of Let's Dance and Blue Jean and mm-hmm. some of that kind of music. And so I would say that I've become much more aware of the 70s Bowie and like that just as much, if not more. And especially the kind of late 70s Berlin stuff, you know, mm-hmm. when he's working with Eno and just really recognizing those Eno touches and even seeing how we had Brian Ferry from Roxy Music here earlier in the week.
That's pretty amazing.
Helping to contextualize things and recognizing similarities between the, I'm guessing it's that little Eno touch between early Roxy Music and Bowie from around the same period. You know, seeing Bowie playing harmonica on Top of the Pops and then Brian Ferry playing mm-hmm. harmonica. And, you know, there's some interesting commonalities there that seem to be in the ether at that time that are fascinating for me to kind of recognize.
Anything that surprised you about him?
I mean, I before I started to really work on the show, I didn't recognize or realize the depth of his commitment and interest in other fields of interest, mm-hmm. whether that's literature or film or poetry or, you know, and even his lyrics. If you start to really look at his lyrics, they're not like any other pop lyrics. I mean, there's something very ambiguous and complex about them. They're very rarely kind of simple and saccharine and sappy. So there's something very special about his songwriting that also I didn't really recognize or pay mm-hmm. attention to until I really started to see his career through the eyes through the lens of this show.
Have you been asked the question David Bowie is very often, and how would you answer that?
I would say is an artist. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I think this is a show where, you know, we might want to be inclined to sort of dance around the mm-hmm. idea of, is this art? You know, mm-hmm. people ask us that question. I think this show proves that he is an artist. But it's this more expanded notion of an artist that's beyond one medium, you know, which, again, is so much closer in line to how artists work these days. They're not just painters, usually. They're or sculptors. They're using all kinds of things at their disposal and finding all kinds of collaborators to work with. And he's been doing that for 40 years now. So,
great. I don't think I have any other questions.
Okay.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, I just really can't wait to see people come here to see the show. I really want to be a fly on the wall and kind of capture people's experiences in the exhibition. And I really do think this is a show that has broad appeal to people from all kinds of different interests and background. And you don't have to think you like or know David Bowie to get something out of this exhibition.
Great. Well, very nice to meet you, Michael.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Happy to be here.
I feel like we're being filmed, but we're not. It's very strange, surreal.